Going Linux, episode 255, Computer America, number 77. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy. Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux. We hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. In today's episode, Computer America.
Broadcasting live, it's America's longest-running national radio talk show on computers, Computer America, hosted by national columnist Craig Crossman. Look for Craig's weekly column in your favorite newspaper. This show is being beamed nationwide at ComputerAmerica.com. Keep it here for technology news, computer products, guest interviews, and your phone calls. You're listening to Computer America.
Hello, and welcome into the Computer America show. It's the nation's longest-running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. Computer America is heard around the world and coast to coast. And I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
And welcome into a Thursday edition of the Computer America show. And we have a really great show planned for you tonight. Of course, it is the not the first, not the second, but the third Thursday of the month. Where is this month going? Just kind of flying by. Anyway, and that means it's our All Linux show tonight. Yes. Anything you could possibly ever want to know about Linux, this is the place you want to be. I mean, you know, Linux is here, and it is an important operating system. And if you have any Linux questions, this is really the place that you want to be here tonight. We have a Linux show once a month, and it's a good thing that we do that because there are so many people who say, hey, why don't you have a Linux show? And we say, well, we already do. they come up and complain, hey, what, you should have Linux. Well, we do. We have a whole show every month. We dedicate it. And it's the third Thursday of the month. It used to be the third Tuesday, but then we moved it to the third Thursday for an important reason, and that reason changed. But I figured we're not going to put it back. We're going to leave it. It's the third Thursday of every month, and that means it's our All Linux show. Now, as I said, the Linux operating system continues to become more and more popular. It's an important operating system, and so if you have a Linux question, comment, or suggestion, tonight's the night for you to give us a call. Now, joining us is our Linux expert, Larry Bushy. Larry is the creator and the host of the Going Linux podcast. Larry, welcome into Computer America. How are you?
I'm doing great, and all I have to say is if you're one of the millions of people who call in on other nights than this, call in now, okay? I want to talk to you.
See, they don't need to call in tonight and lecture us about how, you know, Linux is, you know, a very important operating system because, obviously, I think you know that.
Yes, it is.
Yes, exactly
now,
right.
Now, let's kind of set this up and tell you how you can participate with us on tonight's show. It's really simple. The easiest thing to do is give us a phone call. Really, just pick up the phone and dial. It's real simple. 347, that's the area code, 884-8881. 347-884-8881 will get you on and get you through. Okay. Now, we also have an email address set up when we're live on the show. If you don't want to go on the air but still want to ask a question, a great way to communicate with us, just send an email to live, L-I-V-E, at ComputerAmerica.com. You can also join us in our live IRC chat room. From our homepage at ComputerAmerica.com, you'll see right there in the sort of the middle of it, it says interact with the show, and there's a button that says live video and chat. When you click on that, you'll go to our chat room and live video page. And on the left-hand side is the chat room. It'll ask you for a nickname. That's the name you'll be known by when you go in there. It'll ask you to there's a CAPTCHA identification, CAPTCHA. Basically, it's a number or two words. You have to type that in because it wants to make sure that you're a live human being and not a robot or a bot. And then click the connect button. and your browser will move you right into the Computer America chat room. A lot of people in there would love to see you. If you want to get a little more fancy, we also have a button there that says click for IRC clients. And basically, those are additional plugins, depending upon if you're on a Mac or Windows, and if you're using Firefox or Chrome, depending on the platform you're on and the browser you're using, there's a plugin, a client that you can plug in. And what that does is it just formats the chat room that something's more visually appealing. I mean, it colorizes it. It makes its own separate window. I'm using Chatzilla. But they're all there. It'll take you to our free software page, and it's right on the bottom of the page. You'll see the different ones, and you can click on it and see which platforms and which browsers they work for, and then pick one that you like and you know, install the plugin. That's totally up to you. You don't need them. You can see the chat room without them, and it just won't be formatted as nicely, but it's there. And then also sharing that same page is our live Computer America video streaming page.
Have we introduced Larry yet?
Yeah, I did. Yes. Yes,
yeah,
I did.
We did.
Yes, we did.
Okay.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. If you have a comment or question, you can interact with us. But I always ask Larry to pick a topic. So we'll be talking about that. But, again, if you have something that's off topic, but as long as it has to do with Linux, we would love to hear from you. Okay. Now, the topic that Larry picked tonight is the state of accessibility in Linux. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about on tonight's show, the state of accessibility in Linux. And when you go to their show notes page, you'll see there. Now, right at the top of the page, Larry has added something else. He's added a link there that's show notes from previous Linux shows. He's got a link there, too, that you can go to see that as well. But anyway, we're going to start off with the state of accessibility in Linux. Now, when you say accessibility, you're talking about features that are for people who are disabled in some fashion, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And for the past couple of months, I've been helping out the Accessible Computing Foundation with documentation and support and delving into some other topics. And I've been looking into the topic of accessibility quite a bit because the Accessible Computing Foundation is the sponsor of Sonar GNU Linux, and it's that Linux distribution that I've been working with to help with the documentation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this month's user experience episode of the Going Linux podcast is going to be an introduction to accessible computing. And we'll cover some of the same sorts of topics here, but from a different perspective.
Sure.
So this will be kind of double dipping. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, we'll be talking about accessibility here. I expect probably we'll get into a little more cross-platform discussion than just strictly related to Linux. So
now, before you get started again, as I said, if people have a question, they can certainly ask it, even if it's off topic. And in the chat room, we had a question for you. I don't know if you're going to be able to answer because I think he just left. But he says, Larry, why would when I try to install something in Fedora, I click install and the box just shuts? It closes down.
Okay. So the box isn't very descriptive.
No, it isn't.
So
I assume
he's
talking about the installation,
Right. Yeah. So he could be using the Yum, the package manager that Fedora uses. He could be installing from the command line. In either case, it shouldn't just shut whichever box he's in. And it sounds to me like perhaps the installer, the installation program, is corrupted, or either that or there's something preventing it from starting. One of the things that I've seen that causes something to shut down is perhaps you've got what they call a zombie process running. In other words, you had the installation program started and you shut it down, but it didn't shut down properly. And so there's still a remnant of it running. So you might want to just check to see if you do have that situation, and you should be able to go in either through the command line, and I think Fedora has a graphical way to take a look at running processes and see if the if Yum or some other installation program, if you're using something other than Yum, is still running, and terminate that and give it another try. And if not, maybe you can get back in touch with us again. I see he still hasn't joined back, so hopefully he comes back and lets us know how that goes. Or maybe the thing he was trying to install it again and it crashed. But
okay. Now, Internet Ken in the chat room says that the topic you picked tonight is actually timely for him, because he just created a 5 systems with JAWS, OpenBook, Zoom Text. And he's going to install Sonar on a spare system to test. So these are all programs that I know JAWS is a screen reader. So these are obviously all accessibility products. So he says your topic.
And we'll be talking
timely.
A little bit about JAWS as well, and how that JAWS is a Windows-only program. So we'll talk about how that fits with Linux and what the alternatives are as well.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So I have to say that I don't have a disability that would require the use of accessibility software, but I do use it, and I use it out of choice. I know several people who use it out of necessity. And in reality, any of us could find ourselves needing to use this kind of software for a number of reasons, having gotten into an accident perhaps, or having had an amputation, being a soldier who is an amputee as a result of something that's happened on the battlefield. Lots of reasons why someone could become disabled. Those are all disabilities from trauma, but somebody could have had a disability as a result of a disease, or could have been disabled since birth. So lots of reasons why people might need accessibility software, and some people may not be familiar with the term accessibility, and it's known by another several other names, as a matter of fact. In computing terms, it could be accessible technology or adaptive technology. I've heard it called that. Rehabilitative devices, although that may not necessarily involve a computer. Rehabilitative devices are also an example of accessible devices or accessibility in general. Accessible computing, I've used those words here on this broadcast as well. And then assistive devices or assistive technology. So all of those and more are terms that are not exactly synonymous with one another, but they all refer to what we're talking about here tonight in terms of accessibility as relates to computing and computers in general.
Okay.
Yeah. So in general, accessibility, regardless of what it's called, is designed to provide some sort of assistance to people with some kind of a disability
now,
or an impairment of some sort.
Are programs like this, I know, like say Windows versions are tend to be costly, and I know Ken said also that he says it's super expensive software. He said it would nice to see the open source alternatives. Assuming that open source alternatives are free or less cost. I mean, does that carry over to the Linux environment? I mean, are all these programs for sale, are they cost expensive? What do people?
For the software for Linux, everything that we're going to be talking about tonight is free of charge.
Okay.
Including an entire operating system that has accessibility software pre-installed and pre-enabled, so that you could install it even if you were blind. And that is Sonar. There are other operating systems, Linux distributions that are geared towards accessibility, including Vinix, which is specifically designed for the blind. And there are others out there as well. But Sonar is designed not just for blind people, but for anyone with a number of different kinds of disabilities. And much of what we're going to be talking about in terms of accessible software for computers, specifically for Linux, are already in already installed and already enabled in Sonar when you install it.
Good. All right.
Okay. So, yeah, and addressing Inet Ken's point about the expense, I know that if you purchase JAWS, for example, it can cost you anywhere between $1,000 and $1,500 for one copy for one person. You can get assistance from the government, but that is usually through some sort of agency or some sort of foundation that offers to pay for it for someone who's disabled. And those organizations often run out of money, so you have to be quick, you know. And so to have something that is open source, that's available for installation on your computer at no charge, especially if it's something that's cross-platform, is an excellent choice. And if you can find something like Sonar that's an entire operating system that's already pre-installed with all this stuff, and it in itself is no charge, all you really need is a computer. And if you already have one, great. And if you don't, the Sonar Project actually has a program that they use to connect people with computers with people who need them and install Sonar Linux on them. So lots of different options there. I know that speech-to-text and text-to-speech software is also very, very expensive for Windows. And we'll talk a little bit about the cost as well. And it's not just Windows that has this. It's Windows, Linux, and Mac. The nice thing about what's on Linux is that it's available at no charge. And the nice thing about what's available on OS X is much of what's already there is enableable with a click of a mouse. And it is also provided by the good folks at Apple at no charge. So it seems to be only the folks that write their software for Windows that are out to I won't say rip people off. I'll just say overcharge. How's that?
Do you know who develops it? Because, I mean, if JAWS is developed by, you know, an institution or something like that, I mean, it may not be in there. Like, who develops it, and why do they feel it kind of warrants, you know, that $1,500 price tag?
Well, there is a company behind JAWS. I don't remember the name of it. We could probably look it up. But as far as why they charge as much as they do, probably because they can, and because many of the people who do purchase it are receive some sort of subsidy for it. I don't want to imply motives to somebody that I really haven't talked to, but I would suspect that because they can get the money for it, they're going to charge whatever they want, and there's really very little, if any, competition out there.
Okay.
Yep. Especially on the Windows platform. Certainly to buy a Mac or to install Linux on your computer would be competition, but in both cases it requires something more than just installing software on your existing computer that's running Windows. So that's
so
a big
I guess
hurdle
before,
for a lot of people to get over.
Yeah. So I guess before all this all this Linux help, you know, if JAWS was really only developed for Windows, Windows was, I guess, traditionally the computer you used if you were, you know, blind or handicapped in some way.
Well, yeah, and JAWS was also originally developed for DOS. So if you still have a DOS computer, I suppose you could use JAWS. But, yeah, so it's been around a long time. It was originally designed for Windows, and certainly Linux has been around a lot longer than Windows has, but it hasn't gained the popularity that Windows has. So I'm sure that's why they are marketing their software to Windows users and haven't bothered to create anything for OS X or for Linux as well. And again, I really hate to imply motives to an organization that I haven't spoken with. So this is all opinion on my part.
Okay.
All right.
And to some degree, informed opinion, and to some degree, uninformed opinion. So take it with a grain of salt. All right. So we were talking about what is accessibility, and depending on the specific technology or the specific disability, there are a number of different technologies that could be used to assist people with disabilities. And those technologies can be designed to assist with things like mobility. And technology that addresses mobility are things commonplace, things like wheelchairs and walkers and prosthetics. Emergency response is another area where assistive technology gets involved in terms of sensors and alarms to alert caregivers if someone needs assistance. No and low vision. We talked about JAWS as software for Windows that allows a blind person to have an automated software program read them what's on the screen. There's also Braille displays and screen magnifiers for people who aren't completely blind but do have low vision and need magnification to be able to see what's on the screen. Hearing is another affliction, deafness. It would be another condition that would require some sort of assistance in many cases, like sign language could be considered technology that's assistive, or hearing aids or amplification of audio, and closed captioning on television and on videos. Communication, like speech synthesis or speech-to-text, and speech generation devices as well can be considered assistive technology. And then there's assistive technology. I wish there was one for my tongue at this point. There's assistive technology that helps with cognition as well. And that can be technology designed to assist people with cognitive impairments due to dementia or stroke or mental illness or traumatic brain injury and those kinds of things. So we're not going to be talking about physical devices here, but we will be talking about software that can be installed on a computer that will help with help people with some sort of disability. Depending on the software, it may be for a specific disability and usually is. So that's kind of the summary of what it is we'll be talking about.
All right.
So I'm just going to quickly check the chat room, see if we have any questions or comments.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just got a comment from Jonathan in the chat room. Says that he sent something to live at ComputerAmerica.com, and he said that Google has it blacklisted. But that's not the case, because I just sent something to live at ComputerAmerica.com, and it worked. It came through. So something else is going on, Jonathan, because I just sent it as a test, and it came through, and it works fine.
I hear on that, and I'll talk with you after the show, but I have a theory about all that. But
okay.
It does not pertain to Linux and
okay.
What we're talking about at the moment. So.
Okay.
I'm afraid.
Quit clicking the spam button when you get the email from America. That's what's doing it, I think. Anyway, so before we get into specific assistive technology, one thing that I have heard the executive director of the Accessible Computing Foundation say, and I believe it's on the website as well, which is sonargnu-linux.com, I think. And it addresses why accessibility is important. And you might think, well, isn't it obvious that if somebody has a disability, it's pretty important for them to have software to help them out if they want to use a computer? But it goes beyond that. And let me just read the comment from Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
So Jonathan has written on the website, there are 1 billion people in the world with some sort of disability. 360 million of these people are blind and have low vision. 90% of these people live in developing countries. How are they accessing technology you and I take for granted every day? The problem is they're not. There is proprietary software for accessing technology, but it's extremely expensive and out of reach of the people that need to use it in order to access a computer. Did you know that 80% of blind people in the United States are unemployed? That's why this is very important. Sonar is a GNU/Linux operating system based off of Manjaro and Arch, built for people with disabilities. This distribution will help people that are blind, have low vision, low motor skills, people with dyslexia, and even quadriplegics. The goal of this operating system is to cater to every accessible need possible.
All right, and we are at the bottom of the hour, and that is an interesting statement. You're listening to the Computer America Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, on the Boost Radio Network, on the IRN Radio Network. It's our All Linux Show with Larry Bushy. We will be right back with lots more right after these words.
Welcome back to the Computer America Show, and sorry about the intermittent audio loss there. I don't know what that's about, but I'm sure we'll get it figured out eventually. Welcome back to the Computer America Show. Larry Bushy joins us. 34 minutes past the hour, All Linux Show, and we just got actually, are we done with that quote from Jonathan and about?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, yeah. And by the way, those numbers, 80% of blind Americans don't have a job. That's a crazy statistic.
Yeah, yeah, and I haven't done the research to find out where he got the numbers, but he is a blind computer user himself, and I'm sure that in his travels, he's been exposed to these numbers, and I have no reason to doubt them. So even if it's half of that, that's a significant number, that's for sure.
Mm. Especially how important computers are. I mean, his numbers mixed with just I'm sure everyone who's listening, everyone's experience, just goes to show how important, assisted computer devices and programs are, are to people.
Right, and to have them affordable to people is really the key thing as well. And that's one of the reasons why Jonathan started the foundation, and he decided that he was going to develop his own Linux distribution to address the issues beyond just computers for the blind, and try to address as many disabilities as he can with a distribution that's available for free and easily installed without assistance by someone who is blind. And that's what he's got with Sonar Linux. So I'm quite proud to be helping him out a little bit, at least in my small way. So
Real quick, what does documentation entail?
Well, some of the things that I've been doing is I put together a quick start guide, so a user's manual, if you will. We're still working on it, so it hasn't been quite released yet, but we've got a final draft, and we're waiting for some input from the Sonar Linux community, and I'll be doing some instructional videos as well. So for people who have a screen reader, those people who use Sonar will actually have a screen reader pre-installed, can use the documentation that comes on Sonar. So this quick start guide will be on the next release of, or including the next release of Sonar. And then the videos will help those people who have access to YouTube and would like to view the help and training by way of video. And what I hope to be able to do, something that I haven't done so far on the videos that I have produced, is to be able to use some sort of closed captioning. And of course, everything that I do is using Linux and open source software, so this will be a bit of a new venture for me.
Hmm. Okay.
To find out how to do closed captioning on a Linux video editor, so we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
Doesn't YouTube have an automatic closed captioning?
Oh, does it? Okay, maybe that's the quick way out for me. But
I think it does. I think it has a pretty good one too.
I'll look into that. Thanks for that.
Yeah, I used to think it was people just kind of transcribing it live.
YouTube does it, and Google is really great with voice recognition, so they kind of have a.
Is that how networks do it? The big networks do it? I mean, all the big TV. I mean, it's not people. It's actually it's an automated system.
I want to say that might still be people because I see typos on that I wouldn't think computers make.
Yeah, and now in some of the programs that I've seen on the television, you see the closed captioning, they make a typo, and then you see them back over it and fix it. So, I suspect that's people.
Okay. Here's another example of whose people have that profession are squirming because they're thinking, eventually it'll all be automated. Computer.
Well, maybe so, but it's pretty challenging even for technology to be able to do this stuff. And I really think that Google has done a great job of providing real-time translations, as has Apple in their voice recognition and their speech synthesis as well. And so both companies have contributed greatly to that. And there are certainly open source projects for Linux that have provided speech synthesis and on-screen screen readers and on-screen keyboards and all kinds of things that we'll get into as mm-hmm. we discuss this technology.
Yep. Okay. So let's continue on.
So let's get into it. So we have a number of show notes links. The first one is to an opensource.com article. It's an interview with Spencer Hunley, who is an autistic professional, former vice chair of Kansas City Mayor's Committee for People with Disabilities, and according to the article, is the current board member of the Autism Society of the Heartland and ASAN's Kansas City chapter. I don't know what ASAN is, but it's pretty impressive. So the interview was written by someone named Ricky Ensley, who works at Red Hat as the community evangelist on the open source and standards team. And Red Hat, of course, is a Linux distribution. So I'm not going to go into detail of what was covered in that interview. I provide the link just for your reading pleasure and for your edification. But there's a good deal of information in there about where we are with assistive technology for the open source world and for Linux described in there. And some of what we're going to be talking about here today in terms of specific software is included in that article. Some of it's not. So
ASAN, by the way, is the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network.
So, there you go. Yeah. I knew somebody would be able to Google that, as we thought.
Cool.
Okay.
I just
so,
knew it.
So, go ahead.
I just knew that. I didn't have to Google it.
Oh, you knew that. Oh, okay.
Okay.
Good. Yeah. We believe you, Craig.
Uh-huh. I have a bridge
right,
to so someone's side.
Yeah. So some examples of open source assistive technology, and most of these are actually software applications that are installed in Sonar, and because they are Linux software packages, they can be installed in any Linux distribution. What distinguishes Sonar is the fact that these are already pre-installed and in most cases pre-enabled. So you really don't have to do anything to get started with the accessibility software in when you're using Sonar Linux. The first is a screen reader. So we've talked about JAWS, and Orca is the open source screen reader that's used in Linux. It's available only for Linux, so it is not a cross-platform mm-hmm. software. Let me back off on that. It's available for Linux and BSD and Unix-based systems, except for OS X. And OS X has been customized so much that Orca won't run on it without installing some additional software. So it doesn't run natively in OS X. Yeah, I'm sure you can get it to run, but
yes.
I don't know how well or why you would do that given that
OS
X provides.
Yeah, Apple will, it's built as part of the OS X operating system. You can have it read aloud anything that is on your screen. So,
yeah, so they've done a really good job
yes,
at Apple. VoiceOver is the technology that they use, and it's available in both OS X and in iOS. And the screen reader there is particularly good. It has some nice, clear voices in multiple languages, and it's something to aspire to. They, as with most things from Apple, they may not be first, but when they do bring something out, they do it right. And VoiceOver is another example of that. Orca is, as I said, an open source screen reader that's available for Unix operating systems, and it does not have voices of the same quality as VoiceOver does, or even as JAWS does at this point in time. But from speaking directly with Jonathan Nadeau, he is working with the Orca team to help them to include some better voices for the Orca screen reader. And so I'm sure that it'll only be a matter of time before those are incorporated into Orca and eventually into Sonar as well. So as the case with sometimes with open source software, it does lead ahead in some areas and it lags behind in other areas, and the quality of the voices on Orca today is lagging behind a little bit, but it's getting really, really close to being much, much better. So Orca screen reader, if you're using Linux, look for that in your software manager if you have someone or know someone who needs a screen reader. And in fact, I've used a screen reader myself when I was studying for school, when I was so tired that I could barely keep my eyes open to read the words on the screen. I had the screen reader read it to me, and it helped. It helped a lot. So there are many software applications like Adobe Reader that have a screen reader built into them, but they don't apply across everything in the operating system. And that's what a screen reader does for you, whether it's JAWS or Orca or the one that Apple provides.
Right.
That's what
it works with everything. Yeah, because it's part of the operating. If it's running in the operating system, it's going to be able to read it, you know.
Exactly. So. And the one thing that Jonathan has done with Sonar that many other Linux distributions have struggled to do, and he's actually accomplished this, is he's gotten Sonar Linux so that when you use the CD, the live CD or a DVD or a USB stick during the installation process, as soon as you start up the live environment, where before you even install, the screen reader is operational. And after you do the installation on the first boot, the screen reader is operational, which means that a blind person could install Sonar from scratch. So, without assistance, which is the key thing.
Yes.
So the next piece of software that is available on most computers, Windows, Mac, Linux, whatever, is a screen magnification program, some sort of screen magnifier. And in Linux, it's usually part of the desktop environment. But it's usually one of the accessories that is available in the accessibility settings by default. And it's usually a matter of just toggling a switch to turn it on. And there are usually some sort of keyboard shortcuts to do the magnification decrease the magnification. And you can use screen keyboard shortcuts to turn magnification on and off as well. So screen magnification.
There you go.
Easy for me to say. Is simply that. It's something that increases the size of what's on the screen so that you could see a portion of the screen and zoom into it. You could consider it zooming in and zooming out. That's exactly what it looks like. And it's for people with low vision who need that magnification. All right. And the next thing is an on-screen keyboard. And this would be for touchscreens is what it's popularly used for these days. But for people with disabilities who have use of a trackball or a mouse but can't use their fingers on a traditional keyboard, the on-screen keyboard, in combination with a trackball or a mouse, can be a godsend to them. And you can also use many of the on-screen keyboards to play back macros, if you will. So you can press a key or a key combination, and it will type a pre-recorded, you record it, phrase, if you want. So if you have phrases that you use routinely, you can record them and just speed up your typing using the on-screen keyboard macro facility. And in combination with an on-screen keyboard is some additional software, head and eye tracking software. Now, much of the head and eye tracking software that's out there requires some sort of assistive devices or can interface with assistive devices that require some sort of dots to be placed on your head so that they can follow you, or some sort of additional device on your head or over your eyes. But the head and eye tracking software that comes on Sonar and is available for most Linux distribution is called Enable ViaCam, and they short it to eViaCam. And all it requires is a camera. And not necessarily a high-definition camera by any stretch. So if you have a webcam, on your computer, or you can install a USB one. In combination with the on-screen keyboard, you can use EviaCam to follow your eyes or follow your head motion and use it to position the cursor over a key, and with a pause, typically, it will press that key for you with nothing more than moving your eyes or moving your head. So for quadriplegics or someone else who has a disease that has disabled their motor functions, or someone with low motor functions, this can be an excellent combination as well. And that software as well is pre-installed in Sonar and ready to go.
Does it use it uses a standard webcam to accomplish
this? Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
That is right.
And so you make some tweaks to adjust it to your particular style of motion. If you're particularly slow or particularly quick, or if you need pauses in there because your motor control even of your head is not consistent and you can't move it smoothly. So there are a number of adjustments you can make in EviaCam, and those are all in the preference settings, and there's a great deal of documentation on the EviaCam site, and I believe we've got a link to that site in the show notes as well.
Amazing
software.
Yeah.
And until I started getting involved with this, I didn't know that half of this stuff existed.
Yeah.
The next software in our list is not something that's included in Sonar, but it is something that was included in that article that I mentioned, and it's called Dasher.
Does this have anything to do with Christmas? Probably on Dasher?
It could be.
No.
It could be. You might get it for Christmas in your stocking, I guess.
Okay.
But it's a text entry interface is what they call it. And I haven't used this, but they talk about it as information efficient text entry interface driven by natural continuous pointing gestures. So it's another one of these software programs that allows you to operate the computer one-handed or with a joystick or a touchscreen or a trackball or a mouse, very similar to the head and eye tracking software or the keyboard, on-screen keyboard sorts of things. But it operates a little bit differently. And it is also available for Palm computers and wearable computers, Palm top computers.
Mm-hmm.
This is obviously some old old documentation here.
Yeah,
so really. I don't know whether that includes things like tablets, but wearable computers like Oculus Rift, that kind of thing. So I'm amazed that they would develop their software for something so expensive, given the quote that I read from Jonathan, but it's all experimental, good experimental stuff that leads to good commercial software eventually, and hopefully open source software that's free for folks to use.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, the last piece of software that is in the list here, and we can talk about some others if you like, but this is something else that's installed on Sonar and is available for not just Linux computers, but Windows and OS X computers as well, is a font for people with dyslexia to help them to read. And people with dyslexia have a problem with mixing up letters of words, and when they go to read, they read words incorrectly because of the perception. And in the documentation for the Open Dyslexic font, that's the name of the font that we're talking about here, it says, your brain can sometimes do funny things to letters. Open Dyslexic tries to help prevent some of these things from happening. Letters have heavy-weighted bottoms to provide an indication of the orientation to make it more difficult to confuse with other similar letters. Consistently weighted bottoms can also help reinforce a particular line of text. The unique shapes of each letter can help prevent flipping and swapping of the letters, presuming.
Yeah.
So, and as I said, the font is available for download. We have a link to the Open Dyslexic site. You can install it on any operating system that will accept fonts and allow you to apply it to your word processor or your entire system-wide operating system, depending on whether or not you have those settings available in your particular operating system.
Is this,
I think Windows,
is
Mac,
it free?
And Linux.
Is
it is free. Yes, it is free. It's
I'd like to see a sample of it.
No charge.
Do they have a link so we could actually go to the website and see what a sample of the font looks like?
Yeah. So in did I include? Yes. So the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th link down.
Ah, yes, I see it.
Dyslexic font.
Yeah, I see it.
And yeah, it's kind of weird looking. But you can see that it is kind of weighted on the bottom.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
Heavily weighted. And it's certainly readable by somebody who isn't dyslexic. But for some reason, this particular font is even more readable to someone with dyslexia because of the way the font is designed.
And I guess it comes to no surprise that their entire website is in that font.
The entire website. Yes,
yeah, it is.
Yes, it is indeed.
But, yeah.
So one of the things I'm doing, I mentioned that I'm creating a quick start guide for Sonar, the operating system, and I will have that quick start guide available once we publish it in the more standard word processor fonts, open source fonts, of course, but I will have an entire version available in the Open Dyslexic font for people with dyslexia who need to read the manual.
Yeah, I'm looking at this font. I mean, I can see how it's weighted on the bottom. Now, obviously, I don't see, though, how does being weighted on the bottom – I know dyslexia, primarily you reverse things. You know, the old standard, you know, joke, you know, I used to be dyslexic, but I'm KO now. In other words, you tend to swap or reverse the letters. How does that prevent you from actually swapping or reversing the letters? I'm not quite figuring out how that works.
Sometimes the letter D and the letter P, for example, or the letter B and the letter P, to someone with dyslexia look very similar.
Uh-huh.
And so when they're writing more than when they're reading,
those two
letters can get flipped. And even when they're reading as well, it can interfere with their reading of a particular word. And so by weighting the bottom of the letter, you can see that the letter D or B would have heavy weighting away from the stem. You know, it's a circle with a stem on it, if you look at it that way. And the letter P would have the weighting closer to the stem.
Mm-hmm.
So they would look very, very different from one another, not only because one's upside down from the other, but because of the weighting. And apparently, because of the way dyslexia works with the brain, that simple weighting, adding a little more fabric to the bottom of the letter, if you will, a little more ink, makes a big difference. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about here.
Very cool. Well, and again, that head and neck tracking. Software,
yes.
That's very, very cool. And again, it's a mouse replacement. It works with any standard PC equipped with a webcam. No additional hardware is required. It's completely free, open source, and basically it just tracks, you know, where you look. It's completely hands-free. You can control your computer with intuitive head movements. No need to use your hands. It's wireless. Obviously, no cables, no dots, no additional hardware required.
Right.
I mean, it's customizable. Pointer speed, you mentioned, in case your neck is, as you said, you were having some difficulties even controlling your neck. And it's specifically designed to eliminate the need for assistance after installation. So there it is.
Right.
And you mentioned
that. Yeah, obviously with installation you'll need some help. But
yeah.
Once it's installed and once it's set up, it should make it a lot easier to for someone with low motor skills to be able to use the computer. And for people with ALS, for people who are quadriplegics, for all kinds of different conditions, this can be make the difference between being able to use a computer and
Excellent.
Not.
All right. Well, listen, we're at the top of the hour. We find ourselves there, and we're going to continue on with Larry Bushy. When we come back, we're going to go to emails that Larry gets throughout the month and that deal with Linux problems, and we certainly are going to read them. And again, if you have a Linux problem or suggestion or comment, we're here. Again, 347-884-8881 will get you on and get you through. And we're going to do that in the next hour.
Computers run the world, and we run computers. Call us or send us an email to live@computeramerica.com.
Hello and welcome into hour two of the nation's longest running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. This is the Computer America Show, and I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
And we're continuing. we just got Mario in the chat room, says, I think you guys should do two Linux shows per month. So there you go. Obviously, popular title, topic.
All right. Well, that's 1-4 and 0 against. So there it is. It's looking in his favor.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Yes. So again, Larry Bushy, owner, he is the does the Going Linux podcast. And he's here with us again on the third Thursday of the month, and we do our all Linux show. So we're going to shift gears now, because in the first hour we talked about accessibility and we talked about all the different products. Very interesting. But now, as I said, we're going to shift gears and we're going to move into the email portion of the show. And again, you can see everything. Again, just go to our show notes page at computeramerica.com. You'll see the link there. And Larry, I guess the first email you're going to get for tonight is from Jim, who listens in Cypress, California, has a question.
Yes, and it's about file sharing on a Windows network using a Linux computer. Jim writes, love the show. One of these days, thanks to your practical analyses, I'll have gone Linux completely. But in the meantime, I have a nagging question, and all my internet forum searches haven't made it clear for me. I'd love to hear it addressed on one of your shows. I've been setting up my own simple Windows networks and helping friends and associates with theirs for decades. It's dirt simple. You plug in a router, you plug in the network cards, and it works out of the box.
Boy, that is pretty simple.
Yeah. Why then, here's the kicker here, why then is it so difficult for a Linux machine to share files with the Windows machines on those networks? I've done it. I've gotten Ubuntu, CrunchBang, Mint, and a few others over the years to share files on my home network of mixed Windows 7 and Windows XP machines. But it took so much tweaking and researching and issuing strange commands in terminal windows that right now I couldn't do it again. Mm-hmm. Whenever I try a new distro, it always finds my network card, finds the network, and gets my Linux machine onto the internet. But when I look in the file manager for other machines on the local network, I drill down as far as the workgroup, and then it fails to mount. I found numerous forum suggestions, and they never seem to work right away. But after I've tried enough different combinations, I guess I wake something up. Then I can share files one way or the other, sometimes both ways. It seems to me there must be a right way to do it. Maybe you could just tell everyone what that is, and then I can ignore all of the misinformation floating around on the internet. Thanks for all you do, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jim, it used to be a lot simpler with Windows XP, a lot simpler.
Sounds to me he's never had an experience with Novell networks, you know, talking about.
Yes.
Okay.
I remember those as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had to take a course on that. You had to be Novell certified. It was really complex.
It's not that long ago that you needed an expert to just set up a network, and now, you know, you're expected to be able to do it on your own in your home without any assistance.
It's getting easier. It's getting a lot easier. I mean, so many of the appliances and things you can buy today will for example, I just got a new Epson printer today, okay? The Epson XP820. They're going to be on the show next month. I had the 800, went to the 810, and went to the 820. Each one is although it was so simple, the newer one gets even more simple. I mean, I literally put this thing out of the box. It found the network. All I had to do was put the password in. It's basically all I had to do. And it set itself up, did everything, works right out of the box. Beautiful. I mean, in order to set up a printer network before, you know, it was a lot of work. Hardware today and software today is becoming much easier for people to do. It's literally out of the box. But there are circumstances where if you have to do something that it wasn't designed to do, or at least not out of the box, it can still be quite difficult.
I think the most difficult thing is what Jim is struggling with, which is the cross-platform sharing of files. Mm-hmm. And there's a very simple solution for that that I'll talk about in a second. But addressing your comment about printers, on Linux, it's just as easy as it is on any other operating system. You go to Add Printers, and if it's on your network and you're connected to your network, it shows up. You click Connect. It installs whatever it needs to install or sets up, because all the drivers are usually already pre-installed on Linux. It just chooses the right one, and you're off and running. And if it's a combination device that also has a scanner, typically, as soon as you plug it in, if it's a USB printer, it installs everything. You don't really even have to click Add a Printer. It just goes and does it. If it's on the network, though, you do have to click the button, but it's dead simple. It's really, really easy. But Jim's problem is not that. Jim's problem is he wants to share files between a Windows machine, Windows 7, Windows XP, and a Linux computer. And he's mentioned several distributions of Linux that he's gotten working through some sort of mysterious incantation over a terminal of some sort. So to make it very, very simple, Jim, the easiest way to be able to share files across your network, cross-platform, with absolutely no trouble, whether it's Windows, Mac, Linux, BSD, OpenSolaris, Android, Chrome, doesn't matter. Put a network-attached storage device on your network, and everything will connect to it. And put your files on that network-attached storage device, and everything sees it. It doesn't care what the format of the drive is. It doesn't care that most network-attached storage devices use Linux. It's designed for you to do that. And that's what I recommended to Jim, is that if he can afford one, go ahead and purchase one, and that will solve his problems. But in the exchanges I had with Jim, one of the things that he forgot to do, which makes this very, very easy to share a folder on Windows with Linux, is he forgot to set up sharing. The most simple things are the things that will get you in the end. So all he really had to do in Windows was right-click on the folder and indicate that he wanted to share that folder across the network, and it would have worked for him. And it should work that easily and that simply. Now, you can go in and you can set up Samba shares, and you can set up all kinds of things, but networking, especially Windows XP and earlier, was as simple as sharing the folder and then navigating to it through the file manager, looking for the other computer on the network, and then it would just open that particular folder on that other computer as though it were a drive on your Linux machine. If you restart your Linux machine, you have to reconnect or remount that folder. And there are ways to get it to permanently mount, which are probably the things that Jim was doing through the help of the forums and the other places he got these incantations. But, it should be very, very easy to even set that up. But the easiest way, don't mess with it. Just get a NAS device and use that. That's the easiest. They're inexpensive these days by comparison. And if you can afford it or you can get one on sale, so much the better.
Okay. We got another question.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I didn't even think of it. I was thinking about all the different ways that you could, kind of get them all to talk to each other and that kind of thing. And then, network has storage. That's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. If they're all on the network, hang the file server off the network as well. The file server being the network attached storage device with a little embedded Linux computer to run it. And the little embedded Linux computer, you don't have to set anything up, but you just plug it in and it's accessible on the network. So it's the easiest way to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's go to David, who has a question for us about Lubuntu.
Yes, Lubuntu.
Lubuntu.
So you've heard of Ubuntu.
Yes.
Or as Charles called it, Ubuntu. Well, Ubuntu is a Linux distribution that is from Canonical, the company Canonical, who develops Ubuntu for the average desktop computing user. They also have server versions that they provide, and they provide support and services for people using Ubuntu on servers that they charge for. Lubuntu is a variety of Ubuntu that uses a different desktop manager. And just for new listeners, maybe we should define the difference here with desktop managers. So a desktop manager or desktop environment is an option that you have on Linux that you don't have on Windows and Mac. And that's because Windows and Mac only offer you one. So they don't even tell you that they have a desktop environment that they're using. They don't have to. You don't have a choice. But on Linux, you have lots of different choices. So if you want your Windows to have black borders with green stripes and to wobble as you move them across the screen, you can do that. If you want your Windows to have tabs on the bottom and nothing on the top, you can do that as well. If you want your Windows to have no window decorations at all, you can do that as well. And much of that is controllable either through the desktop environment or through some options on the desktop environment. So lots of different options there, much too much to get into this email now that we've explained all of that. He says, I've installed Ubuntu version 14.04 LTS, LTS standing for long-term support, alongside of Windows XP, and don't understand why it took me so long to convert. I have not run XP since. I have installed extra software beyond what came with the distribution and have installed the few Windows programs that I don't see an equivalent of. Some font issues here and there, but that's all. That is okay. One of the things I installed was my Wi-Fi printer, a Brother HL1680DW. I used the driver supplied by Brother and followed their install instructions. You probably didn't have to do that, David, but you probably got a few extra features than you would have if you had just used the open source drivers. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we are also using a printer with Windows Vista, iPad 2, and two Android phones using Brother Print and Scan app. The printer has stopped working with my Ubuntu machine, and I'm unsure where to go to figure out how to fix it. The printer still works with the other devices. I have gone to the forums, but they don't help.
Yeah.
Thanks, David. Okay, so it may be that the driver you got from Brother somehow has become corrupted or is malfunctioning in some way. So the first thing that I would recommend, David, is that you go back and uninstall that driver and see if there is a driver available from within Linux. I don't know how old that particular Brother printer is, but if it's relatively new and not absolutely brand new, as in it was just released last week, the Linux community has probably already developed an open source driver for it. I would first see if there's a driver for it already in the Linux kernel. And you just do that by uninstalling the one you installed, and hopefully they provide you some instructions on how to do that in the documentation that came with that driver. And once you've got that done, he said it's a Wi-Fi printer, go into the printer settings and just click Add a Printer. Look for that printer on your network. Click Connect, and it should find the driver and install it. Now, if it's a printer that the driver isn't already in the kernel, and 14.04 is not the latest release of Ubuntu, so it's possible that it doesn't have that driver in there. Mm-hmm. You might want to try reinstalling that Brother driver again. It is possible that something damaged it or damaged one of the libraries that it uses. And by reinstalling it, you could just simply fix it. Since it was working before, mm-hmm. I suspect that's what's going on there. But if you can use the open source driver without having to use the Brother one, that's probably something that will work much better for you in the long run. As I said, it might not have all of the features that your driver that you got from Brother has, but if there's features that you're not using, then there's no reason not to use the open source drivers. If there are features that you purposely bought that printer to use, like double-sided printing or something like that, and they're not included in the open source driver, then you probably do want the proprietary driver from Brother, but look on their website, see if they have an open source driver that they've developed as well. Sometimes they do, rather than the proprietary driver.
Yeah, the open source though will typically not have the specialized features of the printer. Like as you said, it has duplex printing. You may or may not find it on the open source, but you certainly will find it on the actual driver. But then that driver might be working on your operating system. So.
Yeah, and modern open source drivers for printers typically are getting more and more of those features added in.
Good.
So,
good.
And duplex printing, double-sided printing is one of those. Scanning is something else that in the olden days of Linux, printer drivers was not included in some. And if you've got a really antique printer, it's probably not a Wi-Fi printer anyway, but the development on those drivers probably has stopped and it's still not available. But if you've got something that's relatively modern and if it's a Wi-Fi printer, it probably is, then you should be able to find a driver for most printers, Wi-Fi printers, especially if it's one that's designed for use with Apple. What's the feature what's the brand name that they call their Wi-Fi over the air?
AirPlay.
Yeah, and Google has a similar sort of thing. So it should work. And try the open source driver first, David, and then if that doesn't work, go ahead and reinstall the driver that you downloaded from Brother. You probably don't have to download it again. If it was working once, it's probably going to work again, but at least give it a try and reinstall it.
Hey, Larry, we got two questions in the chat room here.
Great.
First one says it's from he says, I have a Linux question from a friend who isn't here, so I probably won't.
Friend,
I won't.
Right.
Yeah, a friend.
Okay.
I won't be able to fully clarify what he's looking for. He says, but he says, I believe he said the system at his work is running Arch Linux. Okay.
Yes.
And he was trying to run a script automation with the slay command. Sounds something out of World of Warcraft, which I assume is some sort of kill process style command. And his question is, but it doesn't seem that Arch includes the slay command natively. He wants to know, are there any other alternatives that you might look at?
Yeah. Well, if it is a kill command, then there is a kill command that's on all Linux distros that I know of. Yeah, and it's just kill, K-I-L-L, and then you need the process number, or the process ID, rather. Yeah. Or you can kill, for example, if you wanted to terminate Firefox from running, and you knew what the process ID is, and you can go into a process monitor and look for it, and it'll be some number of digits. You could say kill and then the process ID, and then it would stop Firefox from running. But to make it even easier in the terminal, you can just type the word kill and then Firefox, or kill the word all and then Firefox, because maybe there are some additional plugins or something that are running in addition to Firefox. And by saying kill all Firefox, it will kill everything related to Firefox. So that's the kill command.
Okay.
And that would be the alternative if indeed slay is that. So I don't know what it is. I don't use Arch. Arch is one of those distributions that is designed for people who like to tinker with Linux, who like to set up a very bare bones Linux and add the programs that they want.
Yeah.
So they start with something that bare bones. And so it's likely that it was set up by someone who knows Linux quite well. So if you can get in touch with whoever installed it, great. Go ahead and do that. If you're still having problems and you can't find somebody who knows Arch Linux, there are ways to download these things from Arch, but there is an alternative to Arch if you wanted to stick with that, called Manjaro. That is a distribution that is already pre-set up, much like Ubuntu is, or Linux Mint, or Fedora is, but it's based on Arch. So if you wanted to stay with the same architecture, you could go ahead and do that, or you could go to something that's a little bit easier to set up and use and support if the person who originally set it up is not available or unwilling to support it for you. So lots of possibilities there. But try the kill command. And if you need instructions on how to do that, at the terminal, just type MAN space kill.
Okay.
And that will give you the kill manual.
Okay.
Yeah, I tried Googling it, and it seems like everywhere, especially on the Arch Linux wiki, is, you know, they're all referencing kill command themselves.
Yeah.
So, that'd probably be the best way.
Although
I did read a forum post, and I don't know how this came up. I guess someone was trying to run a Windows application on a Linux computer, but apparently it's just a joke, and they're like, the day that Windows makes something that doesn't suck is the day they make a vacuum cleaner. I don't know how that came up, but just looking for the answer.
With apologies to Dyson. Yeah, okay. The other question.
The other question.
The other question in the chat room is from Mario. I think Mario was a new Computer America chat room participant, so welcome to him.
Well, welcome. Yeah.
He says, we were speaking of the dyslexic fonts and everything. We were talking about. He says, speaking of fonts, he says, I want to get Tahoma, T-A-H-O-M-A, on Linux Mint 13.
Yes.
Yet all the solutions you find on the internet do not work.
Right, okay.
Uh-huh.
So there is a Microsoft font set available in the repositories. And I will open up, I'm not going to install them, but I'll open up the software manager here and put in my password. And I think it's something
say it quietly so we can copy it down.
The password?
The
yes.
The key logger is coming through now. It's coming
WORD123. Or something along those lines. So let's see. Microsoft font in the manager.
And Tahoma. Tahoma is the name of the font.
Tahoma. Okay, that's not one.
No.
MS. Let's try that.
Okay.
Searching skills are not helping me today.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Font TTF. Yes. So it's TTF-MS, as in Microsoft, Core Fonts-Installer.
Mm-hmm.
And that will install the Microsoft fonts for you. And let me click into this.
Is Tahoma one of them? Is Tahoma a Microsoft font?
Yes. It's one of the ones that's installed on Windows by default. And I'm pretty sure it's one of those that came from
Arial.
Microsoft as opposed to – as opposed to one that came from Adobe or somebody like that.
Mm.
I don't see it in the list, but they have Verdana, which is another Microsoft one. Andale and Georgia, that's another Microsoft font.
That's always been on my mind.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Okay, so there are some Microsoft fonts there. I didn't see Tahoma in the list, but it may just be there, or it may be a separate listing. So give that a try. And check in the Linux Mint forums. Go in the Linux Mint forums, since you mentioned Linux Mint, and ask in there, and they will answer you.
All right.
And they'll be polite about it, too. They're not going to be nasty.
All right. So let's continue on with the next one. This is from Steve. Doesn't say where he's from, but he has an interesting opening sentence.
Yes, he says, love the show, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, many of the emails we get start with love the show and blah, blah. So he's just following along. I've been using Linux for the last 15 years, but ran into the upgrade from hell a couple of weeks ago.
Mm.
The computer dual booted Windows 8.1 and Ubuntu 12.04, which is fairly old now, and I wanted to upgrade the Ubuntu 12.04 to 14.04. I wanted to do a fresh install, not just a distribution upgrade. I'll explain that in a second. To be safe, I made a Clonezilla image of the whole computer and one for my Linux home directory, which is in a separate partition. Then, just in case, I did a regular thing useful on the home directory.
Regular backup.
Right, install. Yeah, that's you know, belt, suspenders, and you know, something else, I guess. Yeah. tried installing Ubuntu 14.04, but it kept failing due to a partitioning error in the installer. There were 7 partitions on the hard disk, 3 of them Linux. Okay, delete all the Linux partitions and leave it. And the paragraph just jumped. delete all the Linux partitions and leave it as free space. No luck, same problem. You talk about that you like Linux Mint, and I have used it in a virtual machine before and like it. So that was plan B. It installed just fine. Great. Now just restore the home partition from Clonezilla, and life is wonderful. But I forgot that when installing the 12.04 partition, I asked for it to be encrypted, and that the key was probably on the root partition that no longer exists.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Clonezilla may have wiped the files on the home directory, or it may have been me messing with the partition size. The partition was a little too small for the first attempt at the Clonezilla restore, so it had to be enlarged. At least there was the regular backup, Linux Mint. Bad news, you can't boot Linux Mint without a valid home directory and user directory with certain required fields, period. The partition was formatted, but empty.
Look, after all the precautions he took about doing this, backing up each and every time he got thwarted. That's horrible.
Yes.
That's tough.
It is horrible. Figured out that I could boot from a live CD, create a user directory, and copy the files from its home directory. Good. Boot Linux, but the home directory permissions are all wrong. Okay, back to the live CD and change ownership of files. Once that was done, I could boot into Linux and restore my backup files, and life was good again. What is listed here are only the highlights. I'm sure they are. You left out all the swearing and and everything that went along with it. The whole thing took about 16 hours, including the initial backups. In the darkest hours, I kept thinking about the Clonezilla backup I had of the whole computer, but restoring with that would mean starting over from scratch. Lessons.
16 hours.
You cannot. Yeah.
Might as well, I would think.
I know. There's a point at which you say, I've already invested all this time. Right. Should I go back or should I go forward? And
perseverance obviously paid off in this case, but wow.
So he's got 2 lessons learned. You cannot have too many backups. A Clonezilla restore of any encrypted home partition can only work with its matching root directory. Question. I knew there was a question in here somewhere. Is there a way to unencrypt a home partition? Keep up the good work.
And we will find out. Is there any way to unencrypt the home partition when we come back? You're listening to the Computer America Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, on the Boost Radio Network, and the IRN Radio Network. It's our All Linux Show. We'll continue on. We've got another News Tips Bulletin Review by Marty Winston coming up as well. Stay with us. You're listening to Computer America.
32 minutes past the hour, and we are in our last stretch with Larry Bushy in our All Linux Show tonight. And, you know, we just kind of got through the email, and we finally got down to the nugget of the question here for Steve. And he wanted to know, is there a way to unencrypt a / home partition? And I'm hoping you have an answer that's not a slide rule, a spreadsheet, and some kind of decoder ring that you get out of a serial box.
Quantum decoding.
So the answer could be yes or no, depending on a number of different things. And if indeed you do not have that special key that was generated or don't have access to it because it's gone, there's no way. You just can't do it. It's encrypted, and that's the purpose of encryption, is so that you can't open those files without the key. And if there was a way to do it, then, you know, the bad guys would be able to do it as well.
Exactly.
And that's the purpose of the encryption. Mm-hmm. So now, having said that, I've got a link in the show notes to an article that is on the Ubuntu Help forum. And there are a number of methods of using the key, once you can find it, to unencrypt that drive, or at least get the files off the encrypted portion of the drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that since Steve has already gotten this done, this is a bit of an academic exercise for him at this point, but there is the long way that they describe, and this one does involve all kinds of command line foo. And then there is, let's scroll down past the long way and see if there is a short way. What do they call it here?
I give up.
This is really recovering your mount paraphrase. And there are two steps to this one, so I guess that's the short way. And then there's instructions on how to remove an encrypted private directory setup. So this goes into a number of different things depending on what actually the problem is.
Which is going to be too complicated at this point, I think. Yeah,
yeah, I think so, especially since he's found the solution after 16 hours worth
of
messing around.
If you want to know, you can always contact Larry, you know, with email.
Yeah, and I'll read you the blog post word for word, command by command, and you can type it in to the terminal.
By the way, in the chat room about that Tahoma, evidently Tahoma, according to iNetCan, is not part of the Microsoft core fonts.
Right.
And evidently Mario didn't want to agree with the end user agreement license, so that probably didn't help much either. So
he may have read it. He may have read it. There might be something in there you don't want to agree to.
Yeah.
Right. You can only use this on one computer. It must have Windows installed and blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay.
And I expect that end user license agreement is there when you go to download Tahoma from the Microsoft site.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways, if you have Windows installed and Tahoma font is installed, it's in a folder on your hard drive.
Yeah.
And you could copy it onto a USB stick and then put it into the font folder in Linux. Mm-hmm. And if Windows won't let you do that,
Linux, you can
boot from a Linux Live CD and go to that folder in Windows and get it that way. But bear in mind that doing that might be in violation of the end user license agreement.
We don't want to do that. No.
Yeah, so, nope.
That's it. So we don't encourage that.
There's always a way, but...
We're not endorsing it. No, we don't endorse that as Computer America. Okay.
Yeah, right.
This next email, by the way, starts off with the love the show, but at least he didn't put blah, blah, blah on that one.
It's kind of like yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. okay.
Yeah. So which one are we talking about here?
Will.
So the next one I have is Will.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Will says, hey there, love the show, just wanted to offer feedback. Oh, great. Good. It took me a few minutes to actually find your episode listing, since they were under show notes, and that didn't seem intuitive place for them. After the fact, it makes sense, but it was still hard as the first-time site visitor to find them best. Will, so he was looking for a place to actually go on the website and play the episode, and it didn't make sense for him to go to show notes when he wanted to play
the
episode.
Was that your show notes or our show notes?
No, it would be on the Going Linux website.
Okay.
If you go to the Going Linux website, there's a player on the homepage that lets you play the most recent episode right there on the homepage.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But he just didn't think show notes was the right place to go to play past episodes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it is.
Well, now he knows.
But I've added a little note under the player for the most recent episode that essentially says that the rest of them are on the show notes page and the link to the show notes page, even though there's a tab for show notes right above. So hopefully, Will, that helps with your finding them from now on, even though you know where they are now. But hopefully that finds the next person who show notes doesn't make sense for playing episodes.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Hopefully. And if I get that comment again, maybe we'll change show notes to show notes and play episodes, links, buttons, and other things.
We go with the term archive.
Archive. Yeah, okay.
Now, if you don't mind,
the episodes.
Yes, it is. It is a word.
Would you mind if I skip down a couple of I want to go to the one that's from Kubuntu.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And would you go ahead and read that one? Because he's actually responding to this week's call for more listener feedback, and I thought this was interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So, Kubuntu is this person's. I'm assuming that's not their given name.
No.
And I know his. No. I know his first name is Jim, but
it's
he
Australian.
Goes by Kubuntu. Yeah. There you go. So Kubuntu writes, "I'm responding to this week's call for more listener feedback.
Okay.
Several Computer America programs ago, you mentioned the utility AutoKey, and then it came up again on a more recent Going Linux podcast." Yeah, that's because it's one of my favorite programs. For several years, I relied on AutoKey for books and articles I write for HTML and PHP programming in Genie, for podcast-related blogs on various WordPress sites, and for banging out notes in Zim. All of those are open source software programs. And by the way, AutoKey, we didn't explain what it is it is like Text Expander or Auto Text on Windows. So it allows you to type in a phrase and you've pre-programmed it. When you type that phrase in, it'll or a word or a few letters, and it'll expand it out to a whole paragraph or a whole letter or a few words, whatever you want it to be. So he continues. Then about 18 months ago, AutoKey suddenly stopped working. I don't know why it stopped functioning and why it still won't work. It was probably some upgrade. Operating system, Python, Cinnamon. I can't sort it out. Over time, I created quite a library of phrases, sentences, and paragraphs, and there are many more I would like to add. I visited the AutoKey forum, but I haven't found anyone who describes a problem similar to mine. Completely uninstalling AutoKey using Synaptic got me a short-lived partial fix. Only the original sample phrases would work, offering a faint ray of hope. But even that didn't work for long. I can't figure out where else to look. For the record, I was using AutoKey on several machines running Linux Mint 16, 64-bit Cinnamon. Yes, I know I need to upgrade to 17, something that will be done shortly. The version of AutoKey is GTK 0.9.0.1. Without going into details, there are plenty of hardware resources available, so a storage of disk or memory space
shortage.
Isn't...
Yeah.
I need that dyslexic font. A shortage of disk or memory space isn't the issue on any of the machines involved. Thanks for your advice and for the podcast and for helping us go Linux several years ago, Kubuntu. So, Kubuntu and I exchanged several emails back and forth trying to figure out why it was working. First of all, he didn't have the most recent version of AutoKey, so I had him upgrade, and he tried that. He's got it running on several machines. He told me that when he does his upgrades, he keeps the old home directory, which has all of the settings and preferences and all of the AutoKey phrases there. And so I was wondering, well, maybe there's something with the AutoKey file that's in his home directory. And so I suggested that on a fresh installation that he try just redoing a few manually, recreating a few of the phrases. That didn't work. So we were kind of scratching our heads a little bit as to what was going on. Eventually he got it working. We're not quite sure how on some of his machines. But the thing that he left out of his email was the fact that he has the AutoKey phrase file in a Dropbox folder, and he shares that same file amongst multiple computers. And so I was wondering, is it possible that the AutoKey file, which is just a text file, has become corrupted or was locked by one machine while another machine was trying to use it? Turns out that didn't seem to be what the problem was after a little bit of testing. And when Kubuntu went in, he looked at some hidden files and folders and found out that there is some JSON file structure overlaid on top of the text files, and we're wondering if maybe those are the files that have become corrupted or something. So since, again, he's got at least a partial solution to the problem, and it's mainly what he was trying to solve, we're probably going to drop investigating this any further. But if there's anybody out there who has run into this problem and knows what's causing it, please let us know, and we'll share that with everyone, because this is, I'm sure, a problem that other people have seen. But as Kubuntu observed, no one was describing it quite the same way as he was on any of the support forums. So maybe it is something unique to him. But he did try it on a fresh install of Linux, freshly installing AutoKey. He even tried the same version of Linux Mint that I was using, and it still didn't work for him, but it worked for me. And the only thing different was he was using it on a different machine than me, and I can't conceive that hardware would cause this. So we're still scratching our heads as to what the problem was or what fixed it, for that matter. So one of those.
Puzzlement
ensues.
All right. Well, we're continuing on. And again, you can see all these emails at our show notes page at computeramerica.com. Just click the email link that's under today's show, September the 18th. This next one is from Joseph.
Yeah. So Joseph says, "Hello, gentlemen." Well, hello, Joseph. Mm-hmm. So formal. Yeah. "I am a recent listener who is enjoying going back through the previous episodes to help me on my first steps to using Linux as my day-to-day. I'm finding your podcast to be very informative with excellent practical advice." Blah, blah, blah. No, he didn't write that. "Could you consider doing a piece on online backup services, things like CrashPlan and Mozy, etc.? I've invested in CrashPlan already, but I'm not sure how well it runs on the Ubuntu-based distributions. Also, I'm setting up a home server for backups, Plex Media Server, and maybe as an occasional family desktop using HP N54L micro server. In general, these days, would you recommend going with the 64-bit version of distros? Am I giving up compatibility in terms of the availability of Linux drivers by going 64-bit? Many thanks, Joe in Ireland." So, Joe, so the question of 64-bit versus 32-bit. It was a number of years ago that 64-bit drivers weren't nearly as commonplace as they are today. And with many of the computers, desktop computers, laptop computers coming out as 64-bit processors as kind of the default these days, Linux is as modern as any other operating system out there, and 64-bit drivers are available for just about everything. So I really don't think, unless you have some esoteric hardware out there, that you're going to be giving up anything at all by going with a 64-bit operating system. As I've said before, the drivers for most hardware is baked into the Linux kernel, so typically you don't even have to go hunting them down and having to install them manually. They just work when you plug in the hardware, or if it's something like RAM or hard drives or so on, it's just there and it works on installation. But there are circumstances where you do need to go out and get a driver, whether it's open source driver or proprietary driver from the hardware manufacturer. And for those who do support Linux, typically these days they provide both the 32-bit version and the 64-bit version of the open source driver. So I really don't think you're giving anything up at all. As far as backup is concerned, the online backup services will work regardless of what your operating system is, typically. I haven't used CrashPlan on anything other than OS X, so I can't really speak to CrashPlan's compatibility with Linux. I know of people who have used it, and I have never heard of any complaints, but that could just be because people don't complain to me about their backups not working online. But there are plenty of them out there, online services that do this, and I'm sure CrashPlan is one of the better ones that you know, certainly you pay for. You can also do your own backup online. If you have a website you can back up to with enough storage and that sort of stuff. But those services that you pay for, they're pretty good as well. And these days you can get an awful lot of online storage from places like Dropbox and Box.com. And the Google folks have some online storage. Even Microsoft offers online storage for a fee. And it's getting cheaper and cheaper. And using that, just simply backing up your files to those services is no less risky in terms of data loss than going with CrashPlan, although you've got to watch out for the security of some of those sites as well. Check them out. Make sure that your files are secure and are encrypted on those sites before you go using them if that's where you decide to go. But, Joe, I think since you've already invested in CrashPlan, give it a try. A quick way to do that, if you want to, is to use a live CD or a live USB stick. Try installing CrashPlan in the live environment, and as long as it doesn't require a reboot of the operating system, you should be able to begin using it and testing it out right from the live environment. Of course, you won't want to use that as, you know, a permanent backup for anything because you're just trying it out, but at least you could test it before installing Linux on your hard drive and see if it's actually compatible. That would be a way to try it out without any risk.
Okay. Oh my goodness, we're back from to Kubuntu.
Yeah, he's got another one. Okay. He writes, "Dear Larry, I know we haven't resolved the auto key problem yet. No problem. I'm still researching on this end, but still you'll figure out why yours works and mine doesn't." Well, there have been a few emails back and forth since you wrote this one. Mm-hmm. But since you have become a Mac user, you may have a quick answer for this. I had to send a friend a document containing all of his online passwords for his WordPress and other related sites. Mm-hmm. I zipped it all up in Linux into a .7z file, partially because 7z appears the file name as well, so that I could email the document to him securely. I just sent him the key/password for the files a few minutes ago via phone text message. Trouble is, he's a Mac newbie and has no idea how to unzip this. He tried downloading 7zx, but either he failed to install it or has no clue how to use it. Is there a Mac program that's simpler for him to use, or a utility native to OS X that will do the job for him? Or is there a different zipping, securing format that I can generate from Linux Mint that will make it easier for him to unlock and open on his end? I have no Mac experience whatsoever. Thanks in advance, Kubuntu.
Well,
yes.
Go ahead.
P.S. See what happens when you stray from going Linux. You start to get going Mac questions. P.P.S. After listening to the Audacity to podcast, and he's got a link to that, this week, my appetite has really been whetted to get AutoKey going again. And, I prefer not to think of them as going Mac questions. I think prefer to think of them as cross-platform questions.
I like that.
Yes,
but
there we go.
Now again, I'm just speaking as a Mac. I mean, Mac natively in OS X will compress and uncompress, and without a special utility to do it.
Yes, it will. Except that this zip file is being compressed by something called 7-zip, and they use their own format for it.
Uh-huh.
And OS X doesn't uncompress 7-zip files natively.
No.
There are a number of programs out there that will do it. There's a link, I believe, in the show notes, and if not, I'll add it in. Maybe I didn't add that in, but there is a program that you can install, and it has the letter 7 in it. I think it's 7ZX.
I would 7-zip.
7-zip.
Yeah, there's 7-zip, but there's something that's a little more universally used on OS X. I don't recall what it is.
Could
right
I
now.
Suggest
I find it?
Why we couldn't we just suggest to Kubuntu, if he's going to be dealing with someone with a Mac, just
use one of the compressions that, you know, that Mac OS X will just natively uncompress.
Maybe he's getting the file, and whoever is giving the file compress it using that program. So it's not really up to him. It's just where he's getting it from.
Well, no, I think he could use something like the .zip extension.
Yeah, or whatever.
7-zip will do that. Something that's kind of plain Jane, generic, and that will work just fine.
Yeah, and he sends it over to Apple. And the person over the Apple side doesn't have to worry about it. It just does it, you know, uncompressed.
Right, exactly. So he was trying to use the special 7-zip format because it was more secure. But use the zip format. It's standard across platform, and it'll work just fine.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, he could even compress something that's generic to Mac and lock it with a password and then just email him the password. So when he double clicks on it, he can say, what's the password? And then it'll uncompress it for him. It'll be very secure either way.
Yep.
Yeah.
You got it. So that'll work.
Okay.
Do we have time for another email?
Yeah, we do. Okay. You want to do one more? We got a short one we can do? I know.
I'm looking for a short. Here's one. David, Flash is no longer working.
Okay.
For some weeks now, Flash has no longer been working for me in Chromium, although it is fine on Firefox and Opera. I believe that I need to add an extra package or something. Pepper? to fix the problem, but I have been unable to find any instructions that work for me. I am using Linux Mint 13 long-term support. I did try Mint 17 long-term support, and Flash worked okay on Chromium, but Chromium kept on crashing and was unusable, so I went back to Mint 13 setup. Thanks very much for all of your excellent work. I listen to every podcast. Thanks in anticipation, David in Sussex, England. Hmm. Well, Chrome and Chromium browsers have a built-in flash, a custom flash from Google, so they don't use the same flash that Firefox and Opera use, which is why it was working on Firefox and Opera and not on Chromium. So it looks like either the Chromium package or the plugin that comes from Google wasn't working, and so installing it again might fix the problem. So uninstall Chromium, reinstall Chromium, and when you uninstall it from the package manager, make the selection to remove it completely, not just uninstall the package, but uninstall all of the preferences and everything else as well, and then try reinstalling it again. That might just fix it. You said that it did work for a time in Linux Mint 17, but it kept crashing. So I'm not sure what was going on there, whether that was a live environment you were trying it from or whether you had actually installed it. So I really can't make too much comment on that for you. But at the very least, I would recommend just try completely removing Chromium. After completely removing it, try reinstalling it. And if that doesn't work, if you don't mind the proprietary stuff that comes in Chrome as opposed to the truly open source stuff that comes in Chromium, uninstall Chromium and just try using Chrome instead. Oftentimes, the proprietary browser from Google gets a lot more attention than the Chromium browser as well. I did find that there were some issues with Chromium on the version of Linux that he was using early on, and they did get it fixed. So make sure you're using the most recent version of Chromium, which I suspect you would be if you're installing it from the repositories. But if you're using Mint 13, it probably is using an older version of Chromium there. So you might want to just go and get the most recent version from the Chromium site from Google and see if you can just manually install that. That might fix the issue.
Okay. Well, listen, we're pretty much out of time, and we solved hopefully a lot of problems and covered a lot of topics, and hopefully it was informative to you, especially if you are or know someone who is physically handicapped. I think you might want to put them onto the show and have them listen to it. But great topic, as always, Larry. And thanks so much. Thanks so much for being with us here tonight. And I know we'll
pleasure, as always.
Yeah, we will see you next month, October, the third Tuesday of the month, Thursday of the month, which is the 16th of October. So we'll see you then.
Right.
All right, great. Well, that about, as I said, about wraps up the show. Again, tomorrow night, we're going to have Aurora PC Repair. That's right. This is a new company. We're going to have the company's founder and CEO, David Flores, on with us. Basically, It's PC repair shops and technicians, but around the country. He's forming this alliance where you, the consumer, no matter where you are, can get your computer repaired either locally in your home or, you know, someplace nearby. It's going to be interesting, and we're going to have him on the show for the first hour. And then in hour two, of course, we'll have computer and technology news brought to you by Slimware Utilities, the official optimization software of Computer America. So thank you very much for listening to our All Linux show, and we will see you tomorrow night. So until tomorrow night, this is Craig Crossman hoping that your hard disk never... We'll see you tomorrow night.
What's a floppy?
New music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.